Okay, hold on. Okay, good morning. This is Bio 231. It's March 4th. You got done with your second test and your results are up on Blackboard. You know, there were some sections that did pretty well, but maybe on average I was a little surprised that it wasn't as good as maybe I would expect. Okay, so I probably should say about how you prepare for these tests, or maybe the first test was so easy that you didn't think that you really needed to prepare as hard for the second one. I'm not really sure, okay? But anyway, how do you prepare for the test?
Study.
Yeah, you got to. The best thing is to do the pre-lecture reading assignments before lecture, fill out those questions, come to lecture. You might need to listen to lecture again when I record them. And then the study guide tells you what questions in the back of the book that I might actually put on the test. So I wouldn't just read over those questions and kind of see what the correct answers are. I would look over those questions like 10 or 20 times and make sure you know what the answer is before you even finish reading the question. Okay, so really work those questions over. And the exam figures, a lot of people got zero on some of the exam figures. So I don't know how that would happen. So again, you can label those exam figures 5 or 10 times and you can get 100% on that part of the test. All right, so that's certainly what I would do. But the other thing is I put my office hours on the board and I would like everybody to come by and take a look at their Scantron, make sure it got graded correctly. And then you can also read the questions over again and see what the correct answer is and see if there is a way that I word a question or maybe there's some kind of systematic error that you're making when you mark your Scantron or find out what's happening. All right, so come by my office hours and we can sit down and I'll look at your Scantron and see what areas you missed. Maybe you missed a little bit of everything or maybe you missed one particular area and I can say, oh, well, all you got to do is pay attention to this and you can move your grade up from a B to an A or a C to an A or something like that, and that happens pretty frequently. All right, so it's important to take a look at your Scantron with the answer key. Just to see, maybe it's just a matter of learning language. Okay. There had some other questions.
I haven't, but it's the lab results. Do those ever get
the lab results? You should get your lab results back in lab every time.
We do, but it's
okay.
On the computer.
Near the drop date, I'll try to put all that information together so that you get an overall feel for how the class is going. Okay. Yeah, it's maybe a little bit early to kind of look at that, but you should at least know how you're doing in lab. And lab is worth 25% of the grade, overall grade in the class. Yeah?
What would you say the section average is?
You know, I have no idea what the numerical average is. I have no clue. So I think maybe in Blackboard it tells you what your particular section is. I enabled that function when I entered the grade, so if you're interested to see. But what I'll do soon is just post everybody's score and you can just look at the whole distribution. So probably looking at the distribution is more important than just finding out what the average is. Okay. Because the average can be skewed quite a bit. For instance, if there were a couple of students that got hundreds on the test, that will skew it the whole class way up. Or if there are some students that got 15s and 20s on the test, so we'll lower the whole average, but that's not a good representation of how the whole class is doing.
Is this curved
grade? No, the grades aren't curved. Grades aren't curved. It's just a 90-80-70 scale. Okay. But there was one question I got to go back and rescore everybody's test that I'm going to include an additional answer on the test. And so what, there are 88 questions on the test, so maybe you will get one more question correct, which turns out to be what, one and an eighth point, so your grade might go up depending on that one particular question. Okay. The question was, what kind of bone is the patella? And it's there were two answers in there. It was it's a short bone as well as sesamoid. So on the Scantron reader, you can only put one answer, but I like both of those answers. So I got to go back. If you put sesamoid, you kind of got gypped out of a point. But I'll make sure you get credit for that. Okay? I won't upgrade it to Blackboard until maybe next time when I get around to recycle, put in grades after the third exam. Okay. You know what? I have no idea. You'll have to see me during office hours. Okay.
Is that what it is?
The sesamoid bone. The patella is a sesamoid bone.
That
was marked wrong. Okay. So you'll get that right. Okay. Okay. Good morning. Way in the back. Okay, everybody. Let me hear the question coming from the way in the back. Yeah. Yeah. That would be an A no matter what. So that's really nice. But for instance, if you have like an 89.9, okay, that's a B. All right. So I don't round up your final averages. But you probably notice that I do round your scores on your Scantron. For instance, if you have an 89.95, then that's a 90%, right? So not the tenths division, but the hundredths division, I round up into the tenths. Okay. So I do round up, but only on your individual test. You still need to get the right number of points in the class. So you can just add your points up as well. Yeah, question. You know, I don't think there is an open lab this week, as far as I know. That was last week. There might be another one. I know that Dr. Sanchez was going to hold an open lab, but then he canceled it, and then maybe he reinstituted it. I'm not sure, but he said he was going to let me know, and then I'll post, I'll give everybody an email when I know. Is there currently a note on the whiteboard right now? That's probably correct. It's just that I haven't been informed, so I hate to pass that on to you to say that that's true. You just got to pay attention to that, okay? And since he's the one that's going to do it, I suppose you could email him too, but I'll probably just send everybody an email as soon as I know about Friday. Oh, Friday's open lab. All right, so that's kind of it for the test. And we're going to move on to muscle. You've been doing some muscle work in lab already. Probably some gross anatomy, knowing where the muscles are located, what the origins and insertions are, how to identify them on mannequins and models and things like that. All right, so let's start just giving you an introduction on muscle. Okay, so all of this could be on the next test. All right, was there another question? Another question anywhere? Oh, you do. Yeah, my office hours are the same unless my boss tells me I have to go do something, and in which case I have to put a note on my door and say I cancel it for this week. Okay, but usually they hate to do that because it's real important to have office hours. Because if students go out of their way to come to an office hour and there's nobody there, mm-hmm. That's bad. Okay, so it's rare that happens, but that could possibly happen. Okay, so muscle. All right, it's specialized. Muscle is one kind of tissue out of how many in your body? Okay. Well, three is close. Four. What are the four kinds of tissues in your body? You got connective tissue. You got epithelium. You have muscle, which is what we're talking about. And the fourth one is nervous tissue. Yeah, so don't forget all that important stuff. All right, so muscle is a tissue all by itself, and it's specialized to do something. And if you're going to pick one thing, what is muscle specialized to do? Muscle tissue is specialized to contract, right? To shorten, to apply tension to things. It can shorten and apply tension to things. So, in the process of doing that, these are all the functions that muscle actually provides for the body. One is movement. Muscles usually have two ends. Opposite ends of a muscle attached to two different bones, and when that muscle shortens, what happens to those two bones? They come closer together. Somehow they approximate each other, right? They move, and usually they move through an articulation, which is another name for a joint, right? And a lot of joints are angular kinds of joints, there's ball and socket joints, there's pivot joints, right? So you know a lot about joints. So muscles provide for movement because they pull bones together. Now muscles can't push bones far apart, they can only pull on bones to bring them together. All right, and another important function of muscle, even though right now you're not moving, you're using a lot of muscle. If you're using a lot of muscle, so what doesn't happen? So that you don't? Yeah, collapse and fall on the floor, right? Because if you were to relax all your muscles in your body, first your head would hit the tabletop, and then your head would bounce off the chair, and then your head would bounce on the floor, right? So that would just make a really big mess. So even though you're not moving, your muscles are providing you with a support for posture, just maintaining your posture, even though you're not moving. Yeah. Pain to start contracting?
Yeah.
No. Does that happen to you?
No.
Like right now, when you're moving your hand, do you feel pain?
No.
Oh, that's good. Well, that can start a reflex. Maybe we'll talk about reflexes, because you would like to withdraw your body from painful stimuli. Okay, so that is a way to check muscle activity and nerve activity by checking reflexes sometimes. But no one will actually give you so much pain that it really damages your body. Okay? So yeah, we'll look at reflexes in just a little bit. But normally, no, you shouldn't have to have pain to move your body. Okay, so posture maintenance. Joint stabilization is another important function of muscle. So for instance, your elbow joint or your knee joint, what kinds of joints are those? Are they pivot joints or ball and socket joints or hinge joints or plane joints or what? They're hinge, right? So they flex and extend. But it is possible to apply force to abduct and adduct the knee or the elbow. And what would happen then if your forearm all of a sudden moved over in this direction? Well, that would break the joint, right? All right, so what protects the joint and maintains that it, or helps it to just work as a hinge joint, are muscles that go across the joint so that you don't abduct or adjunct, because then the bones are actually going to break. All right, so muscles provide for joint stability to make sure that they operate in the ways that they have evolved to operate. The fourth thing is generation of heat. Muscle is important for generating heat, because right now, if you didn't have any muscles in your body, besides being just a little puddle on the floor, what else would happen to you? What else would happen to you if you didn't have any muscles in terms of generating heat? What would be your body temperature? Well, it wouldn't be quite zero. You would be, just the temperature of this room right here, which is maybe about 70 degrees or something. And could you be alive at 70 degrees? No, that's hypothermia. You need to be at what temperature? 98.6, which is significantly higher than 70 degrees. So those muscles provide heat energy for you to stay alive, to maintain homeostasis. So those are the important functions of skeletal muscle. All right, some functional characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other tissues. The special properties include contractility. We talked about that already, right? So bones can't contract, tendons can't contract, nerves don't contract. Epithelium doesn't contract, only muscle tissue contracts. It is also excitable, which means what? Excitable means that the muscle can change state depending on stimulation. It can change from a soft tissue to what? An incredibly hard contracted tissue. All right, so when a muscle contracts, it changes state. And you can control when a muscle contracts, so it is excitable. Muscle is also extensible. That means that once that a muscle, not only can it contract, but it can stretch as well. So muscles can stretch. And then this fourth term right here, elasticity, is after a muscle stretches and you let go, what happens to it? It goes back to its original length, all right, because it is elastic. That's an important property. All right, so you might know that in your arm you have two important muscles. One is the biceps for flexion, and you have the triceps for extension. All right, so let's talk about extensibility and elasticity for a second. So when the biceps contracts to flex your forearm, what does the triceps have to do? It has to, yeah, it has to stretch, right? It has to extend, right? Because, and muscles can do that because of extensibility. And when you relax the biceps, what happens to the triceps? It goes, or it goes back to its original shape because of elasticity, okay? Okay. So there are three kinds of muscle in your body. There's skeletal, cardiac, and smooth muscle. These all are responsible for contraction. Skeletal muscle, you find that it is under voluntary control. This is the only kind of muscle that you can actually control with your brain, cause it to contract. Cardiac and smooth muscle are regulated automatically through the autonomic nervous system. So you don't have to think about your heart rate, right? You don't have to think about the smooth muscle that's controlling the diameter of the pupils of your eyes or controlling blood pressure, right? So you don't have to even consider those things, only skeletal muscle. And as a matter of fact, of all the things in your body that you can control with your consciousness is only one thing. What is the only thing that you can actually control in your body? And that is skeletal muscle. Everything else gets taken care of automatically. So where you look, all right, is taken care of with your skeletal muscles of your neck and your head, all right, and if you have your eyes open or not because you have muscles that control your eyelids, but now how light enters your eye is controlled by smooth muscle of your iris, right, and you don't have to worry about that. Okay. Yeah, we call those involuntary. Cardiac and smooth are involuntary. Skeletal is voluntary. Voluntary muscle. All right, so let's look at some skeletal muscle in detail. And for instance, let's just look at a muscle like maybe the biceps brachii or brachioradialis. All right, and we're going to look at all these things on this slide right here. So here is a nice illustration of a muscle. So here we see a bone, and this is going to be on our diagram right here that looks like the humerus. So this looks like the brachioradialis muscle, for instance. It's not important that you know the name of this particular muscle, but I do want you to know the different divisions of a muscle. All right, so a muscle is going to be attached to a bone via dense regular connective tissue, namely a tendon. So a tendon is a muscle-to-bone connection. What do you call a bone-to-bone connection that's fibrous tissue? That's a ligament, right? So tendons and ligaments are very similar in structure, but they're just used for different purposes. Okay, so this is the whole muscle. Sometimes we call this the muscle belly because if you just look at a muscle lying on the table, it kind of looks like a stomach or something, all right? So it's just a whole bag of contractile elements. And the membrane that surrounds the whole muscle is what we call the epimysium. So there's connective tissue that binds all the muscle components together. That's the epimysium. And if we look at a nice cross-section of this muscle through the whole muscle, we can see that the muscle is broken down into compartments. And those compartments are called fascicles, and sometimes they're called bundles. In this text, they are called what? Fascicles. That's nice. That's a better term for this class. A muscle fascicle. So how do you put a whole big muscle together? You put fascicles together. And around every fascicle, there is something called the perimysium. So here is the perimysium surrounding every fascicle. And if we put all these fascicles together, we put another membrane around everything. That's what we call the epimysium. All right, now let's just concentrate on one fascicle. And can you see structure inside of a fascicle right there? Or is it homogeneous? It's not homogeneous. I see things inside of a fascicle. And let's just pull one of those things out. Here it is right here. All right, and this is what we call a muscle cell. And a muscle cell is really long and narrow, so it looks like a thread or a fiber. So guess what we call a skeletal muscle cell? We call it a fiber. We don't call it a thread. We call it a fiber. All right, and so here is a muscle fiber, and another name for a muscle fiber is what? Just one cell. All right, and then when we look at this, what can you tell me? Do you see any kind of pattern?
Yeah.
On the muscle fiber. Yeah, there are stripes there which we call striations. And these striations match up, all right, with all of the muscle fibers that make up this fascicle right here. So when we look underneath the microscope, we see that nice striated appearance. All right, so that's a characteristic of skeletal muscle, these striations. All right, so make sure you can deconvolute a muscle into its components and make sure you know what the building blocks of a unit of muscle is. So if you're going to make a fascicle, what do you need? What's the building block of a fascicle? It's going to be muscle fibers, putting a bunch of muscle fibers together to make a fascicle. And what's the building block of a whole muscle? It's going to be fascicles. That's right. So you put a bunch of fascicles together. All right, so make sure that you can go up and down in those levels of organization. And then the last thing, around every particular muscle cell, there is another connective tissue sheath, and we call that the endomysium. All right, so you got the three kinds of connective tissue sheaths: epimysium around the whole muscle, perimysium around the fascicles, and endomysium around each muscle fiber. Okay. So I think that covers pretty much everything that's on this slide right here. Yeah, that covers everything right there. Okay. All right, so we said that muscles usually have two ends. Each end is connected to a different bone. So let's take a look at this picture right here. Okay. So, for instance, here would be a nice example of a brachioradialis. And when it contracts, it's going to cause flexion of the forearm. Right, so it's going to decrease the angle between the humerus and the radius right here. And the way that we name the ends of the muscle is by the degree of motion that it's going to produce. So when the brachioradialis contracts, what bone moves more? Is it the humerus that moves, or is it the radius that moves? It's the radius that moves. All right, so the radial end is what we call the insertion, and the part that is attaching to the humerus is what we call the origin, right? So the origin is the least movable end of a muscle, and the insertion is the more movable end.
Is there any on the origin?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And as a matter of fact, if we were to get out a microscope, we'd actually see that there's a really tiny tendon there. So there's always going to be a tendon connecting the muscle to a bone, okay? But in this particular case, it's not really evident, okay? But we do talk about these different kinds of attachment points, all right? A direct attachment, you have really short tendons. The muscle just appears to attach directly to a bone, all right? That's a direct attachment. An indirect attachment is when you have a long tendon or maybe a tendinous sheath that's going to attach a muscle to a bone. And that tendinous sheath is what we call an aponeurosis. All right, so this would be an example of a direct attachment. This would be an example of an indirect attachment. But in every case, there's a tendon there. All right. So let's go back and where are we? We got a muscle, we got fascicles, we got a muscle fiber. And I can't really look into that muscle fiber very well. Let me see if I can. Do I see anything in there? That looks kind of just like a... I almost can see some structures in there, but not quite. But you know what? There are structures inside of a muscle fiber. All right, so if we just look at one muscle fiber, this is what it looks like. All right, and don't forget, we put a bunch of these muscle fibers together, and what do we get? A fascicle, right. Okay, and here we can see striations. You can see dark bands and light bands right here. And it's kind of easy to remember which one is which because the dark band is called the A band. So there's an A in dark. That's easy to remember. And these light bands, right, we call that the I band. And that's easy to remember again because there's a, what? There's an I in light. All right, so that's not exactly how they got named, but that certainly will help you on a test to remember that. Okay, so there must be some kind of repeating unit inside of a muscle fiber that goes from one end of the muscle all the way to the other, and that's what we're going to look at. What's the nature of this repeating unit that goes over and over and over? All right. Skeletal muscle cells, I said, are really long. They could be maybe even a meter long, which is huge. You don't need a microscope to see something that's a meter long, but the diameter is still microscopic. All right, so they still have a microscopic diameter, so you still need a microscope to see a cell. But you might wonder, how is it that a muscle cell actually got to be so long? Because all of your cells are microscopic. The way that it happens is that there are primordial muscle cells, all right, that fuse together to form one big long muscle, maybe made up of hundreds of primordial muscle cells. And after all these muscles fuse together to make a fiber, each one of those nuclei, right, still exist within the one muscle fiber cell. So when you look at a muscle fiber of a mature muscle tissue, you see what? In every cell there are many nuclei corresponding to all of the cells that fuse together during development. Okay, so that's why skeletal muscles are multinucleate. Can you tell me, give me an example of a cell that is the opposite of that? As a matter of fact, it doesn't have any nuclei in it whatsoever. Like red blood cells, that's right. Red blood cells don't have any nuclei. So typically, if you're going to think of a cell, how many nuclei should it have? One. But can you find exceptions to that rule? Yeah, because we know living cells that don't have a nucleus. They don't live for very long. And other cells, like muscles, that have many nuclei. All depends on how they develop. All right, but now when we look inside this muscle cell or muscle fiber, can you see that there's any, are there structures besides the nucleus inside that cell?
No.
Absolutely. There are even more tubes and threads inside the cell. These are what we call myofibrils. So let's pull out one myofibril right here, and you can see maybe 30 or 40 myofibrils that make up the muscle cell. A myofibril you could think of as an organelle. So give me a name of another organelle besides a myofibril. Mitochondria, the nucleus, right? What? Endoplasmic reticulum. These are all organelles. And an organelle is what? Just a little specialized structure that has a special function inside the cell. So these myofibrils, you should really think of them as organelles. They have a particular function, and their function is to shorten, to contract. So we will find the contractile elements of how muscle shortens inside a myofibril. So think of a myofibril as an organelle. Okay, now muscle contraction requires energy. Where does energy come from in your cells? Yeah, ATP. And what organelle makes ATP for us? Mitochondria. So when you look at a muscle cell in illustration, you should see what? A lot of mitochondria, because it takes a lot of energy to contract muscle. And I think we can see some mitochondria inside this muscle cell right here supplying ATP for contraction. Okay. All right, well, let's zoom in to this region right here. All right, and this is the structural and functional unit of contraction inside a skeletal muscle cell. And so I like to use that concept a lot in this class, right, the structural and functional unit of something, because if you understand a structural and functional unit, then you understand pretty much everything about that particular topic. Like, for instance, what's the structural and functional unit of life?
Cell.
A cell. And if you know something about how cells work, the components of cells, you really know a lot about life and how it operates. All right, so what we're interested in is the structure between the zigzag line here and the zigzag line right here. And those are called the Z lines. Sometimes they're called the Z discs because they're really kind of like a plate. They'll go all the way across the myofibril. These are the endpoints of something that we call the sarcomere. So the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle. So if you want to understand how skeletal muscle contracts, you have to understand how that sarcomere shortens. What's going on inside that sarcomere? All right. Well, if we look inside that sarcomere, do you see, is it all homogeneous, or do you see structure inside a sarcomere? Yeah, you see structures inside that sarcomere. So now we're getting very, very small. Can't see any of these things with a light microscope. These are molecules, protein molecules, that make up a sarcomere. Okay. And you can sort of see them on the end right here, these little dots. These are just the ends of a protein. So the proteins are very long and narrow as well. And we've got maybe two really important kinds of proteins and a third that's interesting to understand. All right, the two that are most important is this thick one right here. This is what we call a myosin, and then here is a thin one. That's what we call actin. The third one that isn't too important are these little ones that look like springs right here. These are what we call chitin molecules. All right, so we got myosin, the thick, actin, the thin, and the chitin. And which ones of these molecules attach to the Z-disc directly? Okay, of the two important ones that I was talking about, which ones attach to the Z-disc? It's the actin. Okay, so I see an actin attached to the Z-disc, and actin, actin, actin. But look, the myosin really doesn't attach, only indirectly via the chitin molecule. Okay, all right, so these are the proteins that make the sarcomere shorten when a whole muscle contracts. So there are some bands that you want to become familiar with. All right, the dark band. That doesn't look right, does it? I never noticed that. I never noticed that on this slide. The dark band should go from where? Here to here. Here to, well, that's close. That's close. It kind of got jogged over somehow. It got twisted. So maybe it's just twisted on the screen. I'm not sure. But the I band is where? From the end of this myosin to the end of this myosin. This is the light band. All right, so here is... And the Z-disc is right in the middle of the light band, or the I-band. Right in the middle of the A-band is what we call the H-zone. Okay? And right smack in the middle of the H-zone is the M-line. Why do we call that the M-line right there?
Middle.
Because that's just the middle, right, of the H-zone. Okay, so the I-band starts right here, and it goes across the Z-disc to where the myosin begins in the other sarcomere. All right, so this is the basic structure of a sarcomere. All right, and let's see what happens as muscles shorten. Okay, let's look at this diagram right here. All right, so what do we call the structure between the Z-disc here and Z-disc right here? That's a sarcomere. All right, and what are the two important proteins within the sarcomere? Okay, and where do I have the cursor right now? Which one is that? That's the myosin. That's the thick one. And what is this one right here? That's the actin. Okay, and now let's see. Oh, the A band is nicely drawn in correctly here. The H zone. Notice that the H zone kind of looks light because what don't you, when a muscle is relaxed, what don't you find in this H zone right here? Yeah, the actin doesn't go all the way across. So it looks a little bit lighter. But not as light as an I-band because that I-band doesn't even have any myosin in it whatsoever, right? Okay. All right, so when a muscle contracts, all right, let's look at these different zones. All right, what happened to the H-zone right here? Okay, it's shrinking. It's disappearing. All right, what about this I-band right here? It is also shrinking. And now let's look at a fully contracted muscle. Do you see any I band at all? Do you see any light zone right here? It's disappeared altogether. All right, and the dark band, all right, is still there. And that H zone has disappeared as well. All right, so the other thing to appreciate is let's look at the length of these different molecules when they're contracting. And so the question would be, which one of these proteins, or maybe there's more than one, that contract when a sarcomere contracts or shortens, right? So is it the actin that is shortening, or is it the myosin that is shortening, or what's going on there when that sarcomere shortens? So do you first agree that the distance from this Z-disc to this Z-disc in when a muscle is relaxed is longer than this distance right here after the muscle is contracted? Does that look shorter? Yeah. So the sarcomere actually shortens, right? The distance from Z-disc to Z-disc gets smaller. Can you see that there? All right. Now let's look at the length of this myosin molecule. The length of the myosin when it's relaxed compared to when it's contracted. Yeah. Okay, you know what? maybe you see a little bit of an optical illusion right there, but if we were to measure that, the length of myosin would be exactly the same. All right? Yes, the myosin molecule doesn't change length at all. It stays the same. So that says, well, maybe the actin is changing length, pulling the Z-discs together. Well, here is an actin molecule, and if we were to measure it and measure this length right here, it's the same length. So you can't invoke actin shortening to explain why the Z-discs shorten or come together, approximate each other. All right, so the model that we use to explain how a sarcomere shortens is that these different protein molecules just slide over each other. All right, so there's a mechanism that allows actin and myosin to slide over each other. So if you look at my hands and my wrists, all right, just look at my wrists, when my fingers slide over each other like that, what happens to my wrists? Do they come closer together? But are my fingers shortening? No, can't do that. All right. But if my fingers just slide, interdigitate and slide over each other, notice that my wrists actually come closer together. And that's how a sarcomere works. And that's why a whole muscle will shorten, because a muscle is made up of what? Thousands of these sarcomeres joined end to end to end from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. Yeah. Okay. So a sarcomere is the structure between these two Z discs right here, and it's made up of myofilaments. Maybe let me go back a couple slides. Right. Oops. Yeah, I don't have a picture. So each one of these little dots right here are myofilaments, and myosin is a myofilament. We would just call that the thick filament, and the actin is a myofilament as well, but it's a thin filament. Okay. So how can we explain how these molecules slide over each other? All right. Well, if we had a powerful enough microscope, we could see even some more structure on a myosin and an actin. And so here is a myosin molecule, and you can see it has these little spurs that are sticking off of it. All right, and so could you tell me that this was a myosin molecule right here? Does it have the same color as this one right here? Not really. It doesn't really look the same, but it should be, you know, like red or something. Okay. Well, you can almost see these little bumps right here. These are what we call head groups, the myosin head. And the myosin head can actually bind to an actin molecule, okay, when there's a proper signal inside the cell, and this little head group, right, can articulate. Can you see these little arrows right here? So think of the myosin head groups as like being my fingertips, right? They can bind an actin molecule, and then that head group can articulate, like my fingers can flex. And what happens to my top hand? Does it move back and forth? Yeah, okay. So if my fingertips over here were the Z-disc, when the head groups articulate, what happens to the Z-disc? It comes closer to midline, but the opposite end of the sarcomere is going to shorten too. That Z-disc is going to come to midline. And what happens then is that the myosin head group releases from actin, it extends again, and it reattaches to an actin molecule, and it articulates. Okay, over and over and over again. So the actin and myosin molecules just slide over each other. All right, now the energy that's necessary for that to happen is provided by ATP. And there is an ATPase in the myosin head that actually hydrolyzes ATP that causes what we call the cycling of the cross bridges. So when a myosin head group reaches up and binds to an actin molecule, that forms like a little bridge between the myosin and actin, right? And so we just call that a cross bridge. And in order for actin and myosin to slide over each other, that has to cycle many hundreds of times a second, so we call that cross bridge cycling when a muscle is contracting. Who moves back and forward? The cycling is, all right, here's the cycling, all right? So the myosin head group will bind the actin, and in order for actin and myosin to slide over each other, the head group has to articulate, okay, and then release, and then it extends and binds to actin again. So that whole thing is a cycle that repeats itself. So that's what we say, cross-bridge cycling. That just repeats itself over and over and over again until the sarcomere is completely shortened. All right, so in order for muscle to contract, what proteins have to be able to touch each other? Actin and myosin. Okay, so there has to be overlap between the actin and myosin in order for the muscle to shorten. That's an important consideration. Okay. So here is, I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, so here is a very nice illustration of pretty much a whole muscle fiber. So you might be wondering, how is it that you can control muscle contraction? How is it you can control cross-bridge cycling in a skeletal muscle? All right, so let's look at some structure inside the cell first. So here is the cell membrane of a muscle cell. That's what we call the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear this word sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle. Sarcolemma is a good example of that. Here is mitochondria making ATP for the sliding of the myofilaments over each other. You see this, I guess it's a blue structure right here that surrounds every myofibril. All right, so what again is a myofibril? You should think of that as an organelle of contraction inside the cell. What's the building block of a myofibril? What do we find in there? Actin and myosin. This is true. What are actin and myosin? Those are the general term that describes both of those. That's the, I should have mentioned it at the beginning and I forgot. They're myofilaments. Okay? Actin and myosin are myofilaments. All right, so let's build a whole muscle from the smallest part. All right, so these little dots right here represent actin and myosin, which are myofilaments. If we put a bunch of myofilaments together, we get a myofibril. That's the organelle inside the cell. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we get a muscle fiber. What's a muscle fiber again? That's a cell. And then if we put hundreds of muscle cells together, we get a fascicle. And then if we put bunches of fascicles together, we get the whole muscle. All right, so that's kind of a picture you should have in your mind. You want to go back down the other way? A muscle, if you break up, what's the building block of a muscle? They're fascicles. What's the building block of a fascicle? Muscle cells, or you could say fibers, right? And what's the building block of a muscle cell or muscle fiber? The myofibril. And then what's the building block of a myofibril? The myofilaments. The myofilaments, which are what? Actin and myosin. Okay? So that's the picture you should have in your mind. Okay. Well, there are some other things inside the muscle fiber that control contraction. And it's this blue region right here. That's another organelle inside of a muscle cell that is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And you can see that it's smooth because why? It doesn't have any ribosomes on it, right? It has no ribosomes. So the job of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is not protein synthesis, because that's the job of rough ER. Right? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum in skeletal muscle is there to store calcium ions. Calcium ions. All right, so what was another function for smooth ER that you learned for the first test? Fat synthesis, lipid synthesis. But in skeletal muscle, its primary job is to store but also release calcium. All right, because calcium is going to be the signal that allows for the actin and myosin filaments to slide over each other. Without calcium, muscle can't contract. That's an important signaling molecule for contraction of muscle. Of course, muscle still needs ATP as an energy source, but without calcium ions, muscle can't contract. So where else did you learn calcium is important in your body? In bones. All right, to have nice strong bones. So what do you think is more important, to have proper calcium in your bones so that they're strong, or proper calcium levels in skeletal muscle so that they contract? So what do you think is more important, contraction of muscle or strong bones? Contraction of muscle, because could you even breathe without proper calcium in your muscles. You couldn't even breathe, so you couldn't even stay alive, right? So maybe before you took this class, you thought calcium was important for bones, and that was it. But what? That's not even as important as some other functions that we're going to learn about. Okay. And this is one of them, muscle contraction. All right, so the calcium is in this smooth endoplasmic reticulum, but because it's in a muscle cell, we don't call it SER, we call it the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Because anytime you hear that sarco, that means a muscle cell. And when it releases calcium, the filaments slide over each other, which causes muscle contraction. Okay, well, what causes the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum? There is an electrical signal that comes from a motor neuron, and that electrical signal flows over the sarcolemma of the muscle fiber cell, the electrical signal. But you might then ask, how does that electrical signal find its way around each one of these myofibrils right here, where there's a little tunnel that distributes that electrical signal deep inside the muscle, and that's what we call a T-tubule. And this T-tubule right here is just a short way of writing transverse tubule, because what kind of section did we make through this muscle cell right here? This is a transverse section, right? That's a nice transverse section. So the T-tubules distribute the electrical signal. See that little hole right there? The electrical signal, as it flows over the cell membrane, gets into the T-tubule and flows where? Everywhere, deep inside the cell. And when that electrical signal passes through the T-tubule, it signals the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium, and that floods all of the myofilaments with calcium, causing the filaments to slide over each other. And what happens then when the myofilaments slide over each other? What happens to the Z-discs? They shorten. They actually come together. Okay, so sometimes we call that excitation-contraction coupling that describes the electrical event that comes from a neuron and how that results in sliding of the myofilaments or the actual contraction of each one of these sarcomeres. Okay, the last thing that's on this diagram right here is that you can see that there is a thick part of the sarcoplasmic reticulum right around every T-tubule, and we call those the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. They're just extra pockets that hold a lot of calcium that's going to control contraction. All right, so that is some of the details about skeletal muscle. So what do we call this structure from here to here? That's the sarcomere. Yeah, what are the two important myofilaments that make up a sarcomere? You got actin and myosin here, and myosin is the thick one. And the actin is the thin one. Which one is attached to the Z-disc? It's the actin, all right? So when calcium floods everywhere inside the cell, then the myosin can attach itself to the actin molecule, and it articulates, and it pulls the actin to midline. And since the actin is connected to the Z-discs, are what pulled closer to midline of a sarcomere, and the whole muscle shortens. Okay, so let me read and see what I left out here. Okay, pretty much nothing. Okay, yeah, I talked about all this stuff right here. Okay. I got to talk a little bit about the neuromuscular junction maybe next. All right, so what's a good trick question? A sarcomere shortens, that causes muscles to contract, but what proteins inside the sarcomere actually shorten when a sarcomere shortens? Neither. Well, that sounds really strange. What do you use to explain that theory? The sliding filament mechanism explains that very nicely, right? The myosin and the actin filaments just slide over each other, bringing the Z-discs together. Okay. Okay, muscle has No, I got to find the figure for this. I don't have it immediately available. All right, so let's talk about the three different kinds of skeletal muscle. Okay, so, but they all have sarcomeres in them. And if we look at a cross-section of skeletal muscle, we see that some of the cells look really dark, some look really light, and some have an intermediate appearance. So they have different contractile properties. All right, so there are three types of skeletal muscle. There are some fibers that are very slow in contracting. So we call these slow oxidative fibers. And slow oxidative fibers don't contract very fast, but they can contract for a long period of time without fatiguing. So what kind of muscles do you think you're using right now to just sit up in your chair? Ones that can contract for long periods of time, right, without fatiguing. So that's what we call a slow oxidative fiber, because it's actually using oxygen to produce ATP for long periods of time. Right? Then there are fast fibers, like fast glycolytic fibers, fast oxidative fibers. These, on the other hand, can contract very, very fast, very quick, with a lot of force, but guess what happens to them? They tire very rapidly. They fatigue very rapidly. And so that's why we call those fast fibers. So you have slow fibers and fast fibers. The trade-off is that the slow ones can stay contracted for a long period of time. They don't fatigue. The fast ones can produce a lot of tension, a lot of force, but they burn out very quickly. They run out of ATP as a result of that. So, for instance, if you are interested in becoming a marathon runner, guess what kind of fibers would you like to have? The slow or the fast? The slow ones, okay? But for instance, if you want to be a gold medal winner at the Olympics in a 100-yard dash, what kind of fibers do you need? You need these fast glycolytic fibers to produce a lot of power very quickly, but after you run 100 yards, what's the chance of ever finishing a marathon? None whatsoever, right? Because those fibers are now fatigued. Just interspersed within the muscle. They're just in different, even within a fascicle. Okay, even within, so these are just a cross-section of different muscle fibers within a fascicle, and they're just interspersed. Okay, so they're right next to each other. And so some people, by genetics, by inheritance, some people just inherit more slow-type fibers. Other people inherit more fast-type fibers. And so they just have different abilities, for instance, in athletics as a result of that. Okay, so if you have fast fibers, then chances are you're not built very well genetically to be a long-distance runner. But if you have a lot of slow fibers, for instance, in your legs, then you have, what, a great ability to be a long-distance runner. And there's no way that we know how to switch one fiber type to another. So whatever you're born with is pretty much what you have your whole life. Now, somebody might be able to figure out a way around that, but not so far. Okay?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So would there be fair elevators? They leap, they jump, they're powerful, but they're just great for a long at the same time.
Yeah.
What do they do like?
You know what? They might be a body type that has a really nice mixture of both. Maybe a nice even mixture of both. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, could they really excel at being just a sprinter? You know, maybe not. Or a long distance runner? No, they're right in the middle. Okay. All right, so different fiber types. All right, that takes us to cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle is different than skeletal muscle in a number of ways. And one of the ways is that skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. What about cardiac muscle? Can you control your heart rate? You know, typically only with certain tricks, right? Meditation or something, you can kind of control your heart rate. And actually, as a matter of fact, I can control your heart rate, but you can't control your heart rate, because right now I could say, okay, put all your books away. We're going to have a pop quiz. All right, make sure you have an eraser and a pencil. You got a quiz right now. So what happened to your heart rate? It probably sped up unless you knew I was just playing, right? Okay. So there are things you can influence your heart rate, but it's not like picking up a drink and voluntarily giving skeletal muscle control. You actually have to think of something that tricks your heart rate into slowing down or speeding up. So your heart rate, the contraction of cardiac muscle, gets taken care of via the autonomic nervous system. Okay. But there are some similarities between skeletal and cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle is striated. All right, so that means what if it's striated underneath a microscope? Why is skeletal muscle striated? Because what do you see inside of a skeletal muscle fiber? You see sarcomeres lined up, right, from end to end. Sarcomeres are the divisions within a myofibril. So when you think of cardiac muscle, the way it contracts is pretty much the same way that skeletal muscles contract. Okay, so in cardiac muscle, what are the myofilaments called? I haven't even shown you a picture yet, but maybe you would know already. What are the myofilaments called in cardiac muscle? Because they have sarcomeres just like skeletal muscle, you would say, well, it's got to have actin and it's got to have myosin. Okay, so indeed that's true. And there are Z-discs. Which one of those myofilaments are attached to the Z-disc?
Actin.
Actin and cardiac muscle the same way. So how does cardiac muscle contract? What protein shortens within the sarcomere?
Neither.
They do what? Actin and myosin just slide over each other. Same thing for cardiac muscle compared to skeletal muscle because of that sarcomere. Now here is a difference. Skeletal muscle, I tell you what, tell me the shape of a skeletal muscle fiber or a skeletal muscle cell. What's the shape of it? It's long and really narrow, right? It's a thread. Okay. Does it have any branches?
No.
It's just long and narrow. It's just a linear cell. Cardiac muscle, on the other hand, has branches to it, and it's short. So it's not really a fiber. And since they're short, a cardiac muscle cell doesn't come from many cells during development. It has always just been one cell. So how many nuclei are in a cardiac muscle cell? Just one, all right? A muscle fiber has got hundreds or thousands. But a cardiac muscle is one cell, and it has always been one cell. It never has fused together. So there's one nuclei. Okay. And since skeletal muscle, okay, when the muscle shortens, it pulls on tendons on either end of the muscle. But in cardiac, since the muscles are short, the cardiac muscle cells can't pull on a tendon. They have to pull on what? The cell, another cell that's right next to them. So the cells have to have a really strong attachment point so that if one contracts, it just doesn't pull away from the next cell. All right, so that attachment point pulls the whole heart muscle together so that it can work as a pump. Okay. So there is a special structure between the cardiac muscle cells that we call the intercalated disc. Right? So I think maybe you've seen that probably in lab. So if you look at this slide right here, right, to me that does not look like skeletal muscle, even though what? What do you see that makes you think, could that be skeletal muscle? You see, what do you see in this particular muscle that's similar to skeletal muscle? Yeah, striations. I see striations. And that means what inside this muscle cell? Yeah, you see sarcomeres. And then the myofilaments, actin and myosin, they slide over each other. That's how a cardiac muscle cell shortens. But how do you know this is not skeletal muscle? Because it's not long and narrow. This one is branched, and it's short. All right, so this muscle cell goes from here, all right, to here, and then the branching area, and then from here to here. That's the length of this muscle cell. It's very, very short. And when this cell contracts, it has to pull on this one right here. Otherwise, the heart would never contract. So there's a special area right here. What do we call this area? The junction between the two cardiac muscle cells. That's the intercalated disc. Right? So that's how these muscle cells attach to each other very strongly. But there's another important function of this intercalated disc. Okay, and that is... Right, and that is When the heart, when this one muscle cell contracts right here, what happens to the heart? The whole heart contracts together. Yeah, I like that appreciation. That's a nice thought that you had. Your heart works together as a unit. Okay? But what can you tell me about skeletal muscle in your body? Does it, do all your skeletal muscles contract at the same time? Yeah, only very specific muscles. That's a good thing. For instance, if I wanted to take a drink right now, which I probably do, right? Like that. I can elicit, I can contract certain muscles, but if my skeletal muscles acted like cardiac muscle, as soon as I made a motion someplace, what would happen?
Your
whole body would contract. Okay, and then what would happen? I would need a towel to clean up. All right, so skeletal muscle is a lot different in the way that it is controlled. The heart contracts as a unit. Skeletal muscles are controlled individually. All right, and the reason why the heart contracts as a unit is because in this intercalated disc, there's a special little protein, a tunnel, that allows for electrical activity to go from one cell directly into the next cell, directly into the next cell, on down the line. And those little connection points are those little tubes that allow for electrical activity to move through. Let's see if I have it on this. I might not have a picture of it. I don't have a picture of it. Right? Those are called gap junctions. Okay, a gap junction allows for an electrical current to move from one cell to the next to the next. And that's a special part of the intercalated disc so that all cardiac muscle cells contract together as a unit, which then pumps blood. You can't have gap junctions in skeletal muscle because then you could never control your body. Okay, so that's an important difference between cardiac. All right. And since skeletal muscle cells are controlled independently of each other, one layer of a muscle doesn't have to be coordinated with another deeper layer within a muscle. And this is why we have branching in cardiac muscle cells. Because there's the heart has a certain thickness, wall thickness, so that if there was a cell up on the top that contracted, what does that electrical signal have to do? It doesn't have to move just right or left. That electrical signal has to do what? It has to go through the whole thickness of the heart. And how can it go through the whole thickness of the heart? Because it can go into this cell and then come down into this branch, moves down into the next layer, right? And then down into this layer and then through this branch. So the electrical signal moves through the whole wall thickness as a result of the branching pattern. So that's why cardiac muscles are branched and skeletal muscle fibers don't have to be branched. They're just long and narrow as a result of that. Yeah. Okay, that electrical signal in the heart, yeah, when we get to the heart, we're going to see that it starts with that area we call the pacemaker, and that's the sinoatrial node or the SA node, and then eventually finds its way to the AV node. So we'll look at, it starts at the SA node. Yeah, you don't have to know that in this chapter, but soon. Yeah, it starts in the SA node. In a normal heart, it starts at the SA node. That's okay that you hear about that a little bit ahead of time. All right, so that's cardiac muscle. What's the function of the intercalated disc? That's a good question. It's got two functions. It attaches the two neighboring myocardial cells together so they don't pull apart, but it also allows for direct electrical stimulation of electrical currents going from one cell to the next so that the whole heart can contract as a unit. You don't want one part of the heart to contract, and then a minute later, another part to contract. You want it all to contract as a unit. Okay. Okay, smooth muscle. This is the third kind. Smooth muscle is found in the walls of hollow organs, like blood vessels. Your lungs have smooth muscle. Your iris has got smooth muscle, so your iris can constrict when it's really bright out, and it can dilate when there's very little light. When it's very dim conditions. Let's see. Also, the reproductive tract has smooth muscle. Okay, digestive tract, for moving food through our digestive tract, has smooth muscle. So you're going to see that it is a lot different than cardiac and skeletal muscle. Yeah.
Kind of a weird question.
Okay.
When you get past the elbow, when you get older.
Okay.
And your eye and your muscle to focus harden. Is that a smooth?
Okay. You know, that muscle still might work pretty well, but what's changing that allows you to change your distance of focus from close up to far away? You need a lens to do that. So you do have a lens in the eye, and the lens has to change shape. The process of changing shape to allow you to see is called accommodation, and it's actually the lens that gets hard. It's not really the muscle. I think the muscle might stay pretty healthy, just the lens just doesn't, yeah, it just hardens up and it doesn't like to change shape anymore. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, smooth muscle. Is uninucleate. What does that mean?
One
nucleus per cell. All right, so that could also then give you a hint, how long are these cells? They're relatively short because they only have one nucleus. They haven't fused together. They're spindle-shaped fibers. They're kind of long and narrow, but not as long as a skeletal muscle cell. And spindle means what? Think of a football and take the ends of a football and stretch it just a little bit further. It's kind of what, a stretched out oval with two pointy ends to it. That's what a smooth muscle cell looks like. And it doesn't have striations. So if it doesn't have striations, what does that tell you about how that cell functions? What's inside the cell that actually makes the cell shorten? Okay, sarcomere. Okay, if a cell has sarcomeres, how does it look underneath the microscope? It looks striated. But if it doesn't have striations, what can you tell me about sarcomeres? It doesn't have sarcomeres, okay? But it still has myofilaments, just in a little bit different arrangement. And I'll show you what that arrangement is. All right, smooth muscle, like cardiac, is involuntary. It has filaments made of actin and myosin, but the arrangement is different compared to cardiac and skeletal. It has dense bodies that correspond to the function of the Z-discs in cardiac and skeletal muscle. So what's the function of a Z-disc again on skeletal muscle? What's attached to the Z-disc?
Actin.
And when the actin slides over a myosin, what happens to the Z-discs? They get pulled together. Okay. So in smooth muscle, there are no Z-discs, but there's still something that gets pulled together when actin and myosin slides over each other. And that's what we call the dense bodies. I'll show you a picture of what a dense body is. So no Z-discs in smooth muscle. There is a spot on the membrane that attaches an actin molecule. We call that a dense body. All right. But the way that the sliding of actin and myosin in smooth muscle, how it's controlled, it's still by calcium. So when calcium enters the cell, actin and myosin slide over each other, and it causes the dense bodies to get closer together. All right. The difference is this calcium in smooth muscle isn't released by smooth endoplasmic reticulum. It comes from outside the cell. So there has to be a channel that opens up on the plasma membrane that allows calcium to enter the cell, and that stimulates cross-bridge cycling as a result of that. All right, so what does smooth muscle look like? All right, here's smooth muscle. Here is a spicule-shaped type cell. Right here you can see it has two pointy ends. Right here is, if we make a cut in this direction, the cells look nice and round. How many nuclei do you see inside the cell?
One.
Only one. You see striations?
No.
There's still actin and myosin in here, but it's not in the typical kind of sarcomere arrangement. All right, so let's see what this next picture looks like. Yeah, let's look right here. So here is a typical smooth muscle cell, one nucleus, it's short. Is it branched? Not branched. All right, and here we can see, okay, actin and myosin that's attached between these two dense bodies. So here's a dense body, and here's a dense body, and then you have arrangements of actin and myosin, okay, that attach these two dense bodies together. And the actin and myosin between these two dense bodies will slide over each other when there is a signal inside the cell that causes them to do that. What's the signal inside a smooth muscle cell that causes actin and myosin to start sliding over each other? That is that calcium signal. Where does that calcium come from? It comes from outside the cell. So calcium comes from outside the cell. It goes inside, diffuses everywhere inside the cell. The actin and myosin slide past each other. So it's going to pull these two dense bodies together. And then what happens to the cell when the dense bodies get pulled together? It kind of just puckers up. The whole cell just kind of shrinks down. All right, and so that's how contraction happens in smooth muscle. All right, and since there's not a nice uniform arrangement of actin and myosin, it just kind of takes this random arrangement all over the surface of the cell. You don't see any striations in smooth muscle. Okay, and so I don't know, be able to compare and contrast cardiac muscle with skeletal muscle and smooth muscle. Know which one is which ones are voluntary, which ones are involuntary. Know which ones are branched and which ones are not branched. Know which ones have sarcomeres and which ones don't have sarcomeres. And here's a good question. Which ones have actin and myosin? All three do. That's right. But in smooth muscle, it's just not arranged into that sarcomere arrangement. Okay? And what's the structural and functional unit of skeletal muscle? Contraction. That's the sarcomere, right? And in skeletal muscle, where does calcium come from? In skeletal muscle, it comes from that blue organelle, which was at the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And what was the little organelle that that tells the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium? Okay. Yeah, somebody said T-tubule. That's what I was thinking. The T-tubule takes the electrical signal from the cell membrane around all the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that causes the reticulum to release calcium, which then allows actin and myosin to slide over each other. All right, so next time I want to review this again on Monday, just a little bit. So if you got some questions, make sure you ask me on Monday or come stop by my office hours. And then we're good.